The Local Government News Roundup is proudly supported by Davidson. For 30 years, Davidson has been strengthening the local government sector by identifying and providing the people, expertise and experience that local government needs to enhance its capability, productivity and performance. Davidson is nationally recognised for its executive recruitment services and over the past 4 years has built a business advisory practice rapidly evolving into one of the nation's foremost and trusted local government business consultancy firms. The Davidson methodology and approach is simple. Thinking beyond now and aiming to be a valued partner with your local government, not just for the immediate project, but for the next 30 years. Speak to Justin Hanney or Seamus Scanlon to find out more, or head to davidsonwp.com.au. Davidson, your future, your partner.
I'm Chris Eddy. Welcome to Roundup Unfiltered from the Local Government News Roundup. Since the start of the current four-year term for Victorian councils, there have been approximately 40 published arbiter and councillor conduct panel reports in total. What conclusions can we draw from those reports about the effectiveness of the conduct framework in the state? Former Hobsons Bay Mayor and Councillor Sandra Wilson takes a keen interest in councillor conduct matters. She's conducted a review of the published reports and joins me on Roundup Unfiltered today to share her observations, as well as some recommendations for improving the timeliness, consistency and effectiveness of the state's councillor conduct regime. Sandra Wilson, welcome to the Roundup.
Lovely to have a chat with you, Chris.
Great to have you here and to see you. So tell me firstly, why are you doing this piece of research?
That's a really good question, because as a retired councillor, why would I still take such a strong interest in local government and its goings on? One of those reasons is I love local government and I really care about it being the best place that it can in, as a local democracy, to represent communities. The other part to that is I'm a bit of a policy wonk. I love a good process and I love to follow up on things and just see what story can be told. And I think we've all read one of these codes of conduct arbitration decisions and then drawn great kind of interest and curiosity out of what does that tell us about this council? So I thought that looking at all of them, or most of them, would give a different perspective or a wider perspective on what's not just going on in one council, but what might be going on across local government as a whole in this area of councillor conduct and the process that the framework has set up to deal with dispute, conflict, difference. So it's very human, but also has other consequences across the board.
For our listeners outside of Victoria and indeed internationally who regularly listen to the Roundup, can we just provide a little bit of context? When you say you've had a look at all of them, what is them that we're talking about here specifically?
This is disputes, conflicts between councillors or within councils, because as I'll highlight, it's not just between councillors in some cases. We'll get to that detail a little bit later. But these are those conflicts that have gone through a process and arrived at something called an internal arbitration process or a councillor code of conduct process, which is a more formal way of resolving a difference, a dispute within a council. They're all published on the local government website after they've been adjudicated by independent people who are always lawyers, I've discovered.
Yes.
And from that, those arbitrations, sanctions are often imposed. They're not always upheld, and that's the whole process of deliberation about, I'll use the word resolution reservedly, but it is about resolving those differences, but often they're not resolved because,
right.
And we'll get to that later, I'm sure.
Hence one of the problems, I guess, that you'll be highlighting. You talk about it, them being published, in a sense, on the Local Government Victoria website. In effect, they're also meant to be published within a council's agenda papers or minutes papers, aren't they? Does that happen uniformly?
Yes, it seems to, although there have been a couple of examples where I haven't actually found the council having tabled or referenced to it in their published agendas, and that's another line of inquiry. Where has that published arbitration decision gone? But I haven't had the chance to review all, but I have watched council meetings where they have been tabled. So, yes, there's two public forums, the local government website and the council meeting agenda and the recording of the meeting itself.
So you might have partly answered this question. I'm curious as to how do you go about a task like this? What's the approach that you took? Is it simply downloading all the reports, reading them and seeing what falls out, or have you had some other framework by which to conduct the analysis?
I started by just sitting down with lots of cups of tea because some of them are quite long. I read one yesterday that's been recently it's not uploaded, but it has been tabled at a council meeting, which was 60 pages long. Some are as short as 6 pages long. So lots of cups of tea and just having a good read, making notes, seeing if there's any trends emerging. And then I've gone back and I've reviewed them all again more systematically to distill the areas that I thought were of interest in my review. Some of those interests being what are the common issues that are being raised between councillors? How do arbiters actually apply and follow any procedural guidelines that they might have? The presentation of the report, sometimes you have to, they're presented very differently, and sometimes you have to scroll backwards and forwards to find the bits and pieces that you're looking for. I was interested in sanctions that were applied in findings, and that took a more systematic review after having done a first flyby. And it might be interesting to note, Chris, that there were how many, 31 plus the three that have recently been tabled that aren't on the local government website. And this is in the last 4 years of let's say, in a four-year term with one year to go. So 33 from 16 councils for arbitrations, 10 councillor conduct panels from 8 councils.
Right.
So it's a fair bit to work through.
Yes.
Meaty and juicy.
And you make a good point, and it's the meaty, juicy ones that I guess we hear more about because they often attract the attention of the media. But you make a good point about these being within this current four-year term of the council, and, of course, there were some changes to the conduct framework that came in with new legislation, weren't there? So this is also an opportunity, I guess, to put a lens across what impact those changes have had, yes?
Yes, I suppose, but then there's nothing to measure it with from prior terms of council or legislation. And one of the questions that comes out of it for me is, are these all of the issues of misconduct and culture that are being experienced in councils? And I suspect not.
Mm. So just digressing slightly, you talk about culture, and obviously that's a pervading theme here, a bit of a window into the culture of particular councils when you go through this material. There's been a culture review of the sector triggered by the last local government minister. Do you think a reason that that might have occurred is because of the number of these issues that were coming through panel and arbiter reports? Was that a trigger for that?
It could have been. It's a little bit of an unknown. I know that Minister Lean announced that culture review at the Australian Local Government Women's Association conference in that particular year. So there was a fair bit happening around the space of gender and gender equity and reaching targets for 50-50 elected women by 2025. So whether that was as much as an issue or as that general sense that we have, that there are things going on in councils that affect good governance and create this perception of that misconduct is rife.
Hmm. And, of course, there are conduct reforms being flagged as we speak today, which we might come back to a little later on to see how that ties in with what you're seeing from this analysis. But let's take a step back, and can you tell us who typically lodges a complaint? How does it start? Is it individual councillors, groups of councillors, a mayor, a council formally resolving, members of the community, all of the above, or no simple answer?
Easy answer, all of the above. Yeah. Although in some cases, if we go to members of the public and even council staff, there are issues, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later, hopefully. Members of the public have been excluded from some codes of conduct within councils, and they don't have a clear avenue for making a complaint about a councillor's behaviour. So sometimes a councillor will take a complaint on behalf of a member of the public. But it's all of the above. I think the most common, though, is councillor to councillor, and yes, sometimes groups of councillors against another, and sometimes the council making a resolution to go to an arbitration process. Can I just say that if I do slip into IAP and CCP, that we are clear, because two people that I've spoken to recently who I thought would understand what I'm talking about, what is that? An internal arbitration process, a councillor conduct panel. So those are the two formal structures to resolve these issues between councillors.
Good to note. So just before we move off it, the prevalence of a community member having an issue that's taken up by one councillor against another councillor or a group of is not that common. Is that what you're saying?
No, not that common. But sometimes codes of conduct that councillors have adopted have written out that a member of the public can make a complaint. And just to jump to the reforms, it is proposed in the reforms that staff members and members of the public will be able to raise issues through what is proposed as a new model code of conduct across all councils. So the local government policy wonks like me, perhaps, are seeing that is an important aspect to have in all codes of conduct.
Right. Okay, we might come back to that and some other things that are flagged in the conduct reforms a little later on. What are the types of issues that typically lead to a complaint being made?
I'd like to say, without going straight to social media, although it is obviously one of those red flag issues, that it is about communication across the board, with social media being a subset of communication, because some of the issues are comments that are made in public meetings. Some are comments to newspapers that get published. Some might just be in private briefings, and then there's the social media. So there's a lot of poor communication or misinterpreted communication, or genuinely offensive, intimidating, abusive communication that flags there's an issue and somebody wants to resolve that grievance.
And there's various levels of seriousness, aren't there, as to whether we're talking about misconduct or serious misconduct. How does that play out? How does that get determined in terms of whether a matter needs to be, for the uninitiated here, of course, needs to be considered more seriously or not?
Well, I think that's an important point to make. If we're talking about IAPs, as I just mentioned before, that's the process for hearing an allegation of misconduct. Misconduct's defined under the Act quite clearly. Treatment of others, so treating everybody with fairness, dignity, respect, courtesy, objectivity, there's a whole gamut of things that sit under that, plus bringing the council, bringing discredit upon the council, or not observing practicing good governance. So that's misconduct. Serious misconduct, as it denotes, and that's dealt with under the CCP process, is more serious matters such as bullying, serious bullying, conflicts of interest, releasing confidential information. So there is a separation between misconduct and serious misconduct, and sometimes a CCP may look at serious misconduct and downgrade it to misconduct in some cases.
What about upgrading so that it needs to then go to a different jurisdiction such as IBAC if corruption's suspected? Have you picked up on any of that?
No, I haven't picked up on any of that, but I have seen in some of the arbitrations where councillors have made allegations of serious misconduct at an arbitration and the arbiter has said, I cannot consider those because that's not my jurisdiction to consider serious misconduct. So it does not find in that process whether serious misconduct has occurred, but it is incumbent upon the applicant to then either make a further complaint or make themselves conversant with what is and isn't misconduct or serious misconduct.
That all adds to the complexity, doesn't it? Any wonder that people are confused, perhaps, or unsure as to how the system is meant to work?
I think there are definitely aspects to that in my findings. One of the things that, and can I just make a disclaimer here, Chris?
Mm.
And
I'll come back.
And the reason I do this is because I do want to come back to disclaimers. But this is all my own opinion. I'm doing it in a personal, saying this in a personal capacity. I am not representative of any organisation. But the point being that there is a process that sits before an arbitration or a code of conduct panel that is the informal resolution process. So the complexity that you allude to is a lot of these matters possibly could have been resolved at an earlier stage under the council's code of conduct and its informal process. And my conclusion, one of my conclusions is that perhaps some of them should have been. Whether that's complexity or whether that is a choice for councillors to go straight to an arbitration process and use the mechanisms under the Act, that's hard to tell because I haven't spoken to anybody about their choices in choosing to go to make an application for a code of conduct issue.
And I guess we don't know how many matters have been dealt with informally, internally, and not reached a complaint matter, do we? So can we perhaps draw a conclusion perhaps that because these matters have, that one outcome or one reason could be that the relationships have already broken down to a point where people aren't prepared to try and resolve it informally. Is that fair?
That's a possible conclusion, but it can't be told from this analysis. What I can say is the step before an application to be referred to an IAP or a CCP, there is a very important person who's employed by the government called the Principal Councillor Conduct Registrar. So every application goes through that person to make a determination as to whether it should be heard. What we don't know, and here's a recommendation that I will make that comes out of the Sandon review, which Operation Sandon from Casey Council, is that all of the data that goes before the, I'll slip into jargon, the PCCR, the registrar, should be published annually. So then you would get to know how many have been rejected and what issues are making it to the Principal Councillor Conduct Registrar before they end up in the IAP or CCC process, because that's an unknown at the moment. What does fall out of these the decisions, the determinations by the arbiters and panel members, is that even if a complaint, an application is dismissed or findings are not made of misconduct, and that is the case in a fair few of them, that they uphold the registrar's correct assumption that they should have proceeded to that panel process or that arbitration process. They had merit according to the registrar.
Anecdotally over time, a comment I've heard about this whole framework and conduct regime is that it's become more legalistic. The proceedings are carried out more like a legal process, and you've mentioned that most of, if not all of the arbiters, et cetera, are lawyers. Do you agree that that's where we've ended up, with a very legal process that perhaps back initially was not meant to be the case?
Well, I do call it quasi-legal. Because when you have a lawyer presiding over a process where people present their evidence and there are findings and sanctions and there are legal principles that are relied upon, and that's something that has fallen out of my review, things like a burden of proof, balance of probability, a reasonable person test, intent is irrelevant. These are all principles that are used in legal framework, other legal frameworks. So yes, it has, and perhaps necessarily so, but was that the intention? The Act says it should be an early intervention to, without technicality and formality, to resolve low levels of conduct. Is it doing that? I think some of the conduct is low level, but it has shifted to this very formal process that's not supposed to have formality but does. And then when these decisions are made, there are, I think, huge impacts as a result of them being public and tabled and maybe not going all the way towards an early intervention or a resolution as you would hope.
So just on that point about, you know, they should be public, what observations have you made about how councils deal with the final reports? Because they're meant to be tabled in a public session of council, aren't they, and recorded in the minutes. And before changes to the Act, I know there were examples of them being dealt with in confidence because perhaps my suggestion, some councillors didn't want those matters being aired in public. How do you observe councillors deal with the outcomes, or councils, more to the point, deal with the outcomes?
Well, I've only sampled a few, and it's fair to say that the bulk of this work has been huge. I'd love to get to watch the result, see one from woe to go and see it tabled. I've only had the opportunity to observe a couple of council meetings, and I've seen probably the best presentation of an arbitration report and possibly the worst presentation or tabling of an arbitration. So in some cases, you can draw a conclusion that they have reached resolution when it's tabled because they have chosen, the council has chosen to just simply note the decision by the arbiter, rightly so. If there's been an apology required as a sanction, that apology has been made in a very civil way and quite with genuine intent. No, I'm straying into where there hasn't been genuine intent in an apology. I'll come back to that.
Yeah.
But then I have seen a presentation, a tabling, where I think maybe with all best intention, it was going to go through smoothly without any retribution, I suppose, but then retribution has become part of the tabling, and I would say that that is very far from a resolution. One of my recommendations would be to give councils a best practice guidance of how to table the outcomes of these arbiter decisions, to not put councils and councillors into the space of perhaps a further code of conduct being.
I was going to raise that very issue because in the example where you mentioned perhaps an apology was not genuinely given, that could give rise to a further matter, couldn't it? That would be then serious misconduct potentially, would it not?
I haven't seen it come as serious misconduct. What I have seen is where, and this is where you have repeat applications from the same council, you might have a different arbiter, but an arbiter will look back at a previous arbitration and the sanction that was given and say, well, you were asked to apologise 7 months ago. Here you are again. You've learned nothing from this, and so now the sanction might be more serious. because there has been a failure to fulfil their obligations in terms of the sanction that was imposed. So these things can be like a train that never stops at the station.
Yes. This could go off in all sorts of directions. I want to try and keep some structure around it. Can I ask you, when you started this process, did you have any particular assumptions that you expected would be borne out that perhaps weren't?
One assumption, and it was, I'd done a little bit of review about how long do these things take? So I had looked at all the timeframes for how long from an application to a conclusion or a resolution, how long does it take? So looking across all of them, my assumption that they take longer than they should, this is not early intervention and resolution and let's get back to governing well, they take at least 6 months. So sometimes 6 to 9 months for them to go through the whole process.
That's a long time, isn't it, for an issue to be unresolved and to be festering away?
I think it's very problematic. And given that the intent is for early intervention and that any conflict resolution process needs to have an aspect of timeliness, because of that very fact, unresolved business does have an impact on the way that people can perform, the way they feel, and how they get along together. And when you think about a council with people needing to work positively and constructively together with their differences, respectful differences, an issue bubbling along is not going to promote and uphold good governance, in my opinion.
And I'm assuming you would have observed that even in those cases that took a long time to resolve, the initial incident, if we can call it that, could perhaps have predated the start of the process by a significant period of time as well, meaning the whole issue has been going much longer.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Local Government News Roundup is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association. As Victorian councils go to elections later this year, the VLGA is ready to support communities and councils in good governance. A series of workshops has been designed to increase understanding of the local government sector, the work of councils, and the role of a councillor. Registrations are being taken now for workshops in May on Standing for Local Government and Local Women Leading Change. And member councils should look out for the VLGA's 2024 Local Government Election Pre-Candidate Prospectus, available soon. Find out more about how the VLGA can support your council and community during this important time in the local government election cycle. Visit vlga.org.au.
I think that you can get a lot of behaviours in council that are in the grey zone, and it might be that a point in time something happens which then triggers this inquiry into will I be taking this to a process? There are limitations with the IAP process that the behaviours must have been, or the misconduct must have occurred, the alleged misconduct must have occurred no more than 3 months for the application. But that doesn't necessarily mean that behaviours haven't been experienced before that. So, yeah, there's a trickle effect with this.
So timeframes is one thing. Any other assumptions that didn't get borne out by your analysis?
I went in with a pretty open mind, to be honest. I didn't know what I was going to find, but I was an assumption, I suppose you could say, about that quasi-legal process. But it was just a line of inquiry rather than an assumption. And as I progressed, I probably formed a greater assumption that this is moving into a very legal perspective. And then I started to look for things like, well, does this mean we are establishing precedents as a result of these findings and this analysis and interpretation of definitions within the Act? And I think that's being borne out.
Can I assume that you assumed that social media would be at the centre of a lot of these issues, and that was borne out?
I didn't know. I didn't make that assumption. No? I expected it to be there, but I didn't have an assumption, but perhaps I should have, given given what we know. But I didn't know that, I didn't assume it would necessarily be in there.
Yeah. So can we perhaps get on to things that you think need to change, some recommendations for improvements to the process? And given that there's a conduct reform process underway with legislation coming, what would you like to see in there that would support your findings here?
I really would like the reforms to consider what early intervention really means. And if a model code of conduct is coming for all councils, which means no variation across Victoria as to how this process will unfold, that if they are retaining things pretty much as they stand with IAPs and CCPs, and I note there are a few tweaks around those, that they also put into the model code something which is a real early intervention process to focus on resolution, informal resolution, rather than you'll always have to have an IAP or a CCP, formal process of resolution, just because it's not always easy to get people to the table to resolve their differences through mediation or through some informal method, but strengthen the focus on the early intervention prior to this process, because there's a lot of cost involved in this. There's a lot of reputational damage in these processes, albeit saying they're still necessary, but more to be dealt with at an early stage. And I would definitely, if it was all up to me and I had the wand of the minister or the powers that be, is take the mayor out of that early intervention process, that informal one that I'm saying could be strengthened.
Let's talk about that. Why would you want to see the mayor removed from that process, given the mayor's leadership role of the council?
And I'd like to talk about leadership roles more fully if there's time.
Sure.
I think that it takes a lot of skill, even at an informal level, to resolve these kinds of issues and differences and behavioural conduct matters between any people, not just councillors. So I would hope that if the mayor does remain in the process, that they are trained and skilled or supported to do this properly, to bring in things like principles of natural justice, which means that you're not going to take sides, you are going to be impartial, you are going to keep it confidential, and you're going to do it in a timely way. Now, mayors are very busy, as we know, when they're conducting the role, and these things need to be conducted in a timely way. Some codes of conduct within councils do put timeframes around that early resolution process. At the moment, with looking at these decisions, and as I've mentioned before, we've just discussed that there is no way of knowing whether there was an early resolution attempted before they got to this process. So that it would be handy to know, because then you could see how effective or ineffective it has been and whether the role of the mayor has actually been helpful. Sometimes the mayor is party to the issues that are playing out. And sometimes within councils there are alliances and allegiances that might be political or whatever they may be around. That means they can never demonstrate an impartiality to someone who has a grievance. So I just don't think that they are a key factor in early resolution, but only under special circumstances. So that's one of my recommendations.
Just while we're on that issue of the various parties' involvement in these processes, what observations, if any, did you have of CEOs being caught up in the process or council staff? I know you mentioned earlier sometimes council staff can be party to issues or complaints against councillors.
Yes, and at the moment there isn't a clear avenue for staff members or CEOs to raise complaints about councillors. And as you'd know, Chris, that's quite a fraught area given a CEO is employed by the council laws.
Correct.
So if a CEO does have issues, what avenues do they have? That is proposed to change under the reforms. In a couple of cases, I have seen issues raised on behalf of staff, and at least one where the CEO has been the on the receiving end of the misconduct of a councillor. I think that the evidence, this body of evidence, is showing how seriously arbiters and panels are taking the interaction between councillors and staff very seriously, where there has been misconduct and in some cases serious misconduct. That's not to say it hasn't happened in the past.
No.
It's just that it is getting the light of day through this process now.
Sandra, what observations have you made about the various sanctions that are imposed through both the arbitration processes and the CCP findings?
Well, the sanctions are governed by the legislation and the regulations, so there are limitations about what sanctions arbiters and panel members can impose, and that goes anywhere from an apology, and that might be verbal, written, published, and it can be required to occur at a meeting, in the newspaper, on social media, depending where the transgression has occurred, and also up to suspension of a councillor for a period of time that has a limitation on it. I've also seen, which is, I think, really interesting, that arbiters are sending councillors for some training. In some cases, they might be referred back to do their induction training because they clearly haven't understood the role of a councillor, perhaps, performing the role of a councillor. And in some cases, a very specific recommendation, or it's not a recommendation, it is a direction to attend emotional intelligence training.
Right.
And one arbiter gave a specific course that could be undertaken by the councillor at a particular university. And some of the sanctions, particularly apologies or training, may be to the satisfaction of the mayor. So they do put, they do bring other parts of the council into ensuring that the sanction is completed and fulfilled. It's for, that's for misconduct. It might be more serious, obviously, for serious misconduct with longer suspensions and other aspects that may hang off that sanction.
So in terms of suspensions, we generally see sort of 1 month up to as much as 4 months, I think. Is that the maximum we've seen? Yeah.
Yes, yes. I think that the proposed reforms are going to extend the suspension sanctions that arbiters can impose. So that will be interesting to see.
Yes. It won't be in these reports, of course, but there's been some media recently, some very high-profile decisions being appealed to a higher court with varying levels of success. Is it fair to say that there's a more litigious approach being taken to these outcomes, or are they isolated cases?
I'll say they are isolated cases, but there are a few notable isolated cases.
Yes.
Some have been appealed to VCAT, which for, and this is in the CCP domain, there is a right of appeal. There is no right of appeal, as far as I understand, in an IAP, decision of the arbiter is final. But in the CCP area, you can appeal to VCAT. In some cases, it has been appealed to the Supreme Court, which really makes for interesting reading. And I have pored through some of those appeals because I've been interested in the legal side of this process. So, yes, notable occasions of this occurring and having some decisions overturned in the legal space.
Mm.
I'm noting, though, that the proposed reforms will limit the appeal rights in CCPs to issues of technicality, and they must go to the Supreme Court. So that's similar to planning decisions that might be appealed by residents not liking the outcome of a planning decision, that it can only be appealed often, if not at VCAT, then at the Supreme Court on a technicality.
Right. And what about the cost of this process? Can you get a sense from the reports, from the decisions of what it's cost? I imagine you can't really, but has it come up in other ways?
No, but the arbiters can often make the statement about the expense. And if I can just read a quote, arbitrations are a very expensive way to resolve minor matters such as these. So the arbiters, the daily rate for an arbiter and a panel member is published on the local government website. But the costs are not just financial, Chris. I mean, ratepayers would be concerned, I think, about the amount of money that is being spent on resolution of these issues, some of which problems shouldn't occur in the first place. But there are other costs, costs to reputation, and that might be the reputation of the council. It is costs to staff, the staff costs, and costs to health and well-being of people's involvement in these issues. And if I can just go to reputational costs of the individual councillors involved in these, and not denigrating anybody's right to entry into a process for resolution, but if it could be resolved earlier, it would be better, because once these are published, all councillors have roles outside of their councillor role. We know that future employers of anyone goes and looks at things on social media and does a little bit of dig about your character that you might not want them to be doing. But these decisions are now in the public domain and can have an impact on people's reputations more broadly than just in their council role.
Earlier you said you wanted to come back to disclaimers. What did you want to say about that?
Just in the defence of allegations of misconduct, mostly, not serious misconduct, and particularly in the area of social media, and you did prompt me for social media cases. The defence that might be used by some councillors is, I had a disclaimer on my social media page that says, my views are my own.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm not performing the role of a councillor when I said that. And I think that if we're setting precedents, and the examples that are coming out of some of these cases is a disclaimer is often ineffective if you can be clearly identified as being a councillor and performing the role of the councillor when analysis is undertaken in that determination process. So beware.
It goes to the heart of that issue, though, about whether a councillor can ever truly take off their councillor hat and speak as an individual. Just as an ordinary member of the community.
It's interesting you say that, Chris, because some of the determinations and the decisions are actually putting more definition about when a councillor is performing the role of a councillor, which I think helps give clarity in these matters. And so that goes to some of the lessons that we might draw from a collective overview of these decisions.
In the interests of wrapping this up, what lessons can we learn, Sandra?
Well, there's quite a few, I think, for councils themselves. One, for example, is being very specific in the wording of your policies. It was brought to our attention that if your media policy says should consult with the mayor or whatever it was, should rather than must, then you're leaving the door wide open for someone to actually not be able to comply with full understanding. So precision in policies for councils. I think that another one for councils is importantly going to the interaction between councillors and staff is providing a safe work environment, and very interesting to read the term psychological safety of the whole public facing part of council for employees and for councillors and indeed potentially members of the public. For councillors, now I'm not part of local government anymore, but local government is a highly regulated area and likely to get more regulated with the reforms. I'm saying that councils can take some lessons from these decisions and have a little bit more self-regulation in their leadership and some reflection and recalibration. For instance, if you are asked to make an apology or if you become aware that your behaviour has made someone offended or insulted, then take a step back and think about your obligations as a leader of the community and how that marries up with your obligations as outlined under the Local Government Act. Lots of little gems, and sometimes the arbiters are, it's almost like they're singing from a high place to say, open your eyes and take another look and perhaps do it a little bit better. So lots of guidance in there.
Is your analysis going to be published? Are people going to be able to read this? What do you hope happens with it going forward?
I'm just seeking ways for publication at the moment, whether that's self-published, to be determined. It is available if anybody wants to read by contacting. Perhaps they could contact me through you, Chris, in the first instance, because it is timely in terms of the proposed reforms. I will be making it as a submission to the proposed reform process that's underway at the moment. And I think I've got until the 29th of February for that.
So there's a lot in that. Thank you so much for walking us through it. What's next for you? Has something fallen out of this that you're thinking might be a next project?
Well, I'd love to talk to some of the councillors that have been through the process to get that personal perspective. Was it successful? Do they regret anything? Have they learned anything? I think I have a few willing participants, but I have to get them on both sides of the ledger, of course.
Yes.
Because that has to be fair and open-minded to everybody who's participated. Always happy to do something that will improve the culture of local government, because I do. I care a lot about it. You can't unsee what you've seen as a councillor.
No.
You do want to still continue that to make the place where you live a better place. And good governance is number one.
Can you see yourself being a councillor again in the future?
Oh, Chris, the official line there is never say never, but highly unlikely.
Okay, that's pretty definitive. Thank you, Sandra. Lovely to see you and to chat with you about that analysis that you've done. Well done on doing it, by the way. I think it's terrific that someone has stepped up with, certainly with your eye for detail and concern about process to bring that lens to what's been occurring over the last few years. And we'll watch with interest what comes from the current reform process.
Thanks, Chris. Definitely a labour of love, but, you know, I do have a bit of a policy wonk about me, so I can't help myself. But it's great to still be paying attention to the space. It's an important one.
My guest today has been Sandra Wilson, former mayor and councillor at Hobsons Bay. Let me know at the Roundup if you'd like access to Sandra's report. And I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Roundup Unfiltered. The podcast is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association with support from Davidson Recruitment and Business Advisory Services. The Roundup is recorded in the city of Greater Geelong, Victoria, on the land of the Wadawurrung people of the Kulin Nation. Until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now. The Local Government News Roundup is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association. As Victorian councils go to elections later this year, the VLGA is ready to support communities and councils in good governance. A series of workshops has been designed to increase understanding of the local government sector, the work of councils, and the role of a councillor. Registrations are being taken now for workshops in May on standing for local government and local women leading change. And member councils should look out for the VLGA's 2024 Local Government Election Pre-Candidate Prospectus, available soon. Find out more about how the VLGA can support your council and community during this important time in the local government election cycle. Visit vlga.org.au.